So, indeed, what we are going to talk is about conditional numbers, the idea of conditioning, and the idea is to begin very gently with what the way condition began, the studies of condition in the 1940s, and eventually to reach the role of condition in what I believe are very nice recent developments in the problem of polynomial system solving. So let me begin with what a conditional number is. Essentially, in the 1940s, when people began, and people here I have proper names, there are Alan Madison Turing and John von Neumann. When they began doing computations, they realized that the computers had finite precision, that this finite precision created errors in every single step of the computation, and that those errors accumulated. So what they wanted to do is to understand how large could be the final error with respect to the quantity to be computed, and this sort of accumulation of errors depended on two things. One thing was the algorithm you were using to do the computation. We will just skip this part. And the other part, that is algorithm independent, is what we will call condition. So assume we are computing a function phi from a certain domain D in R to dm, and the function goes to R to dq. And so the point is, if I consider a perturbation of my data, I have a data A, and I want to compute phi of A, okay? I want to compute phi of A. And I have a perturbation, let's call it phi of A plus delta A, okay? And let me use here capital delta. So the problem they consider is how much can be amplified, the perturbation, let's look at this as a relative error in the input, in the output I compute, what is the worst case magnification when the perturbation is small. So let's try to give meaning to those words. So first, that would be the error in the output. I put norms, so this number now measures how big is this error. Of course, I am interested in relative errors, right? So I have to divide between the norm of the quantity I wanted to compute on the first place, okay? And that's the relative error in the output. So I now can consider relative error in the input, and the error in the input will be the norm of delta A that I divide by the norm of A. Okay? So the magnification of this error in here is this quotient. Okay? The worst case magnification means that I will consider a delta and I will consider the supremum for delta A smaller or equal than delta A. So this quotient, this relative error, will be bounded by little delta. And the fact that I consider small perturbations in a kind of extreme interpretation means that I take the limit when delta tends to zero. And in this extreme interpretation, I, by the way, eliminate the delta, okay, the little one. So this is what is the conditional number of the problem phi at A. Okay? Fine. This definition is a little bit useless, of course, because it conveys a meaning, but it's very difficult to handle. So, Turing and von Neumann, the first problem they were interested on, and they were solving with computers, was linear equation solving. So essentially they had a matrix A, square, to fix ideas, a vector V, and the phi they were computing was A minus 1 of B. Okay? So they tried to see for little a being this pair, for little a being this pair, what would be the condition, this condition. And what they found is that first, this roughly depends only on A, is independent on B, and is the norm of A times the norm of A inverse. Okay, let's assume we are talking spectral norms to fix ideas. Okay? This is good news. We get a very nice interpretation of what is the condition number that we can somehow handle and understand. Doesn't convey the meaning above, but is more easily dealt with. This one can extend. Let me show an extension. Assume that now we have a matrix R, which is rectangular. Let's say this way. Okay? Here is N, here is M. Okay? So R goes from Rn into Rm, and let's assume it's surjective. Okay? Then, what I can do is I can restrict the as a mapping to the kernel of R perp, and restricted to the perp, this is a isomorphism. So I can consider the inverse, and this is what people call the Moore-Penrose inverse. Okay. So, in this case in which we have a surjective function, we may consider first the problem of computing this Moore-Penrose inverse is a matrix. Again, and this is a matrix, instead of m times n, it will be n times m. And so it has this map has a matrix associated to it in those bases. And you can also consider the problem. Now, the linear equation solving is underdetermined. There are many, many solutions. But one way of determining is that if we are given the problem of Rx equals C, that is to determine, we may try to compute the minimum of the norm of X satisfying this. We can try to compute a solution having minimal norm. Okay? Well, you may try to say what is the condition number, and the condition number again is for this problem is not exactly, but roughly speaking, will be the norm of R times the norm of R Moore-Penrose inverse. This is a dagger, but my capacity of drawing are limited. Okay? Now, one thing that at this time probably makes sense to mention is the following. In those problems, just look at the first to fix ideas, there is a set of possible inputs where the problem does not make sense. So consider sigma, the set of matrices A such that the determinant of A equals 0. Okay? If the determinant of A equals 0, A is not invertible, and then to try to solve, to compute A minus 1 B, simply is nonsense. Okay? So we said that data in here are ill-posed, and we say that the condition number of A in this case, even though it's not well defined, we say is infinity. And somehow in this way we get some continuity. The same here. If the matrix is not full rank, is rank deficient, I will have the same, I can consider the condition number to be infinity. Now, one has the idea, obviously, that the closer I get to this set, the larger this norm becomes, and therefore that there is some sort of relation between conditioning and ill-posedness. Actually, there is something called the condition number theorem, a statement called the condition number theorem, which is a little bit funny because it was proved in 1936, way before condition numbers had this name, that essentially says that the condition number of A is the norm of A divided the distance from A to sigma. Okay? So we get a second characterization of that expression there on top for this problem. The first one is in terms of norm of A inverse. Here is as a relativized inverse to the distance to ill-posedness. Okay. Now let's forget a little bit about, we are not that much interested in error analysis. There is a feature of condition numbers that turns out to be very interesting, is that they naturally occur in complexity analysis. What do I mean by that? Well, some of the algorithms we know, like for instance, I need to solve this problem here, and given A and B, I want to compute X, which is A minus 1B. And some of the algorithms one would use, like Gaussian elimination, simply perform n cube arithmetic operations and give me the X bar. But let's assume that A is positive definite. Then if A is positive definite, one can attempt a different sort of algorithm. Actually, the conjugate gradient algorithm starts with a point x0 in R to the n and constructs a sequence x1, x2, x3, and so on. And the main theorem for the conjugate gradient algorithm in our context says the following. For epsilon greater than 0, to have that the norm of xk minus an x bar. Here I put an A below. This is the A norm, meaning since A is positive definite, A induces an inner product. The inner product induces a norm. That's the norm I am referring to. Is smaller or equal than the norm of x0 minus x bar times epsilon, so to shrink this initial distance by a factor of x epsilon, it is enough to have k greater or equal than 1/2 square root of the condition number of A times log 1 over epsilon. Okay? So we find this is curious. The algorithm is no longer, we don't look at it as a direct algorithm that works a certain number of times and then stops and returns a solution, but as an algorithm that progressively builds approximations to the solution I want, okay? And the quality of the approximation is controlled by the condition number. Okay? So the quality of the approximation xk will depend on this condition number. So we are interested in using condition numbers for complexity analysis. And here comes a problem. Consider the following little problem, toy example. Given B and C real numbers, compute the number of real zeros of x squared plus bx plus c. Okay, we all know how to solve this problem. But just because we all know how to solve this problem, what we know is that on the plane BC, what happens is that there is a parabola, b squared minus 4c, that outside the parabola there are no zeros, inside the parabola there are two zeros, and when we are in the parabola there is one zero. Let's call these regions D0, D1, D2. Now let's try to understand the condition of this problem. Okay, for a certain pair BC. We try to understand the condition of this problem, and what do we find? If we are in here, certainly there will be a little ball which is contained also, we're in the interior of D0 and D0. It will be a ball that is contained in D0. And then when you look at this ball, you look at that expression on the top, and that expression gives you zero. So this is zero if BC belongs to D0, and the same for D2. Okay? Now what happens if I have a point in the parabola? If I have a point in the parabola, you look at that expression there, and what you see is that tiny modifications, arbitrarily small modifications, perturbations of your input will change brutally your output. Okay? So, in relative terms, will change from 1 to 2, let's say, so the change on the top will be 1, but the denominator tends to 0, so we will get infinity. That looks bad. That looks very bad. In which sense? If we ever try to use this for a complexity analysis of this sense, in the sense above, obviously we will get nowhere. We will get nowhere. As a condition number, this helps very, very little. Needless to say, this is a toy example, but assume now that you have whatever, a system of n real polynomials in n variables, that you know that generically has a finite number of roots, and you want to count the roots. What you will have is plenty of regions that have different answers, and in the boundaries between these regions, you will get condition infinity, and inside the regions, you will get condition zero. So, useless. A typical example of another problem of this sort is what we call decision problems. Let me write here. Can you see if I write on the lower part of the blackboard? This? Okay. Decision problems. In decision problems, and these problems are important, theoretical computer scientists make a living out of them. Okay? The answer of these problems are yes and no. Those are the values of these problems. So we have on the one hand problems like the one on top that are, you know, finite value, discrete value, and in the extreme case of a discrete value problem we have a decision problem in which the returned value is not even a number. Okay, simply yes, no. Like, for instance, I give you a matrix A, let's say rectangular, and let's say like this, elongated this way, and I want to know whether there exists y such that ay is greater than zero. Okay? Very, very basic feasibility problem in linear programming. Okay? The answer is either yes or no. Of course, I will have, the usual thing is I will have here answer yes, here answer no, and again, what we would find in such a case is that the condition is zero here if we ever manage to associate numbers, let's say 1 and minus 1, to yes and no, zero here, infinity on the boundary. So we cannot use that definition for getting a reasonable idea of condition for these problems. Does it mean that we need to abandon the idea of a condition-based analysis for the complexity of decision problems? Well, the answer is no, and the person who had the idea, I think is a pioneer in this solution that I will mention now, is Jim Renegar. He essentially did that for linear programming, and the idea is to consider the condition number here and there. Okay, if we have the yes and no regions, or we can simply take any point A here, look at the distance from A to sigma, this boundary between yes and no, I call it sigma, and take as condition number norm of A divided by, I take it by definition now, divided the distance from A to sigma. Okay? Of course, making this definition, just making it, is nice, but the idea is it helpful in any way? The answer is yes, and then what Jim did to show it is that he did a very, very elaborate analysis of linear programming, actually more than linear, conic programming, and with this condition number, and he even recovered the famous theorems on linear programming for integers coefficient being in polynomial time by bounding, when the coefficients are integer numbers, this condition number by the height, in terms of the height of the coefficients. So there is another way we may departure from the canon there on top, and this is the case of multivalued problems. Multivalued problems. What do I mean by multivalued? Let me give you a simple example. Given f belonging to C of x, polynomial complex coefficients, one variable, find zeta belonging to C such that f of zeta equals 0. Well, if your polynomial has degree d, it will have in general d zeros. I am telling you which one to find? No. So even though the problem has a meaning, and everybody understands what do we mean when you say find a zero, we are not saying find any particular zero. We are not putting here some sort of smallest norm. We are not determining it. Well, I put find between quotes because after Galois we know that we cannot find it. Well, this means just give any sort of definition of good approximation and find a good approximation. Okay? Now, for most of the definitions of good approximation, this will make the problem even more multivalued than originally, because even if I have a single root, okay, in the complex plane here, and a good approximation is to being on a ball of radius delta, every point in this ball will be a possible answer, a possible output, legal output on my algorithm. So really, I am in a situation in which, again, that expression there doesn't really make a lot of sense. This problem here also gives an example of this. I may consider this a decision problem, but assume that instead of being simply a decision problem, I want, in case of answer being yes, I want the algorithm to return a point Y satisfying the system of inequalities. Okay? Then there are many points Ys, right? This is a cone, it's actually a polyhedral cone, the boundary of the cones are hyperplanes, and any point within the cone, if the cone is non-empty, is a good answer. So how can we define condition number in those cases? One idea is the following. Our problem now, phi, we can look at it as a subset r to the n times r to the m times r to the q. By the way, when I say r, I could be saying c. You could be considering problems over the complex numbers as well. I can consider some sort of set V, which is the set of the pair x, y, such that x, y belongs to phi. Okay, this is a relation now. Okay, and I can even, for a given x, I can consider Vx, the set of x such that, the set of y such that xy belongs to V. Okay, some sort of fiber. Now, for different problems, and here you will have the example, an example soon enough, because Jean-Pierre Dedieu will explain this for a specific problem. But for different problems, one can consider a quantity, let's call it mu x y, that somehow measures the condition, or the quality, you can understand this as the quality, of y as a solution for x. Okay? If we have such an expression, there are three options that open up for us. First option, I could consider mu x to be the infimum of the y in Vx of mu xy. Okay? Let me give you an example of this. Let's return to this case here. Ay greater than 0. Okay? Assume I have my cone. The boundary of my cones are hyperplanes like this. This is Aj equals 0. Okay, Aj x equals 0. Okay? And when I have a point y, such that, let's say, Ajy is greater than 0, so assume that the point is a solution, I can consider this distance. Okay? If this is the origin of coordinates, this defines an angle here. Okay? And this angle here, I can call it theta j of y. Okay? So I can define mu of x, y to be 1 divided the sinus of theta j. Let me just 1 minute. Norm of y. Oh, it's okay. 1 divided the minimum over j of the angles theta j of y. Okay? So I am saying essentially the condition is what? My point is within the cone. When we see the cone this way from the top, if my point is here, the condition will be 1 divided this distance, which is how near I am from the boundary. Okay? And this is... Yes?
Your x here is the matrix A, right? X is the beta?
Yeah. Yeah, good. Very good, yeah. Yeah. Otherwise... thank you. And this we can write as actually norm of y divided the minimum over j. Here I will make a simplification. I will assume to simplify that norm of aj equals 1 for all j. Okay? That is all rows have norm 1. Otherwise I should have to make more complicated this expression here. This is the minimum of aj transposed y. Okay? So it makes sense to consider mu of a, and here I will change notation, I will write it this way because this is it's called the GCC condition number, and this is more or less well known in the literature. And this condition number will be the minimum, the infimum, actually turns out to be a minimum. For all the y's, for the time being, let me put in the v sub a of this mu of a and y. Okay? Now, what happens if v sub a is empty? What happens if the answer is no? Well, it turns out that there is a very nice way of solving this, which is, here is sinus. Sorry, here is the sinus, not the angle. Take the sinus of the angle. There is a very nice way, which is just, I can consider all y, in R to the whatever it comes here. And I simply need to put absolute value here. Okay? This expression is an expression that when it will be infinity, when this minimum is zero, otherwise it will be fine. And this minimum is zero when the cone is non-empty, but the interior of the cone is empty. So essentially you have a cone which is degenerate like this. Okay? So any point in the cone, by definition, will have to be on its boundary, and then what you will get here is infinity. This makes sense. This captures the idea that the degenerate cone like this is, on the one hand, the most difficult to decide because it's the cone in which a small perturbation can either make the cone disappear in thin air or can make it fatter and have real interior. So, well, this is one example in which we solve
inside, it makes sense to look at the closest of the hyperplanes.
Yes.
Because you need to satisfy all of them. If you're on the outside, you only need to violate one of them. So why is it terrible to be way on the outside but to be on one of those hyperplanes? Because your mu will then be infinite, but in terms of any relative distance.
No, no. If you're well on the outside, then one the minimum of this will be negative. The minimum will be negative, and then if it's very, very much on the outside, it will be very negative. If it's very negative, it will be. No, it's okay. So, for the second and third options, let me mention, the problem is the following. We have F is a square system of homogeneous complex polynomials, okay, and we want to, so since it is homogeneous and it's square, well, first, since it is homogeneous, we are looking for zeros on the projective space. Zeros in the projective space, they always exist, okay, so there is not the problem here of yes, the decision problem, yes, no, is not, it doesn't exist, that's fine. The system is square, so it means that generically it has a finite number of solutions. And the problem is compute let's write an approximate zero. An approximate zero of F. And the zero is a line of zeros, of course, a projective zero. Okay. Now, for this problem, Jean-Pierre will explain, will give with more details. This is correct, Jean-Pierre? Yeah. Jean-Pierre will give with more details, so I can skip them. The notion of mu f zeta, where zeta is a zero, okay? Okay, so let's assume we have this notion. What we will eventually find is that from this notion on, Mike Shuve and Steve Smale defined a certain mu that we will call mu max of F, which is the maximum over the zeta such that F of zeta equals zero of mu F zeta. Okay? And this is, you may look at it, you see, it's a more pessimistic approach of condition than this one. I am taking the best condition solution as the one that will give me the condition of the problem. And in here, I am taking the worst condition solution as the one that will give me the condition of the problem. Which one you need to take when you are analyzing a given problem? Well, essentially, you are working with a certain algorithm, and when you work with it, you will see which one you need to define. And then third, this is Shuve-Smale. And then the third one is essentially a variant that was introduced by Mike that is the following. Is the third one will be an average. It will be between the worst case, the worst condition solution of your problem and the best condition solution of your problem. And it will, let me call it mu 2. And let me, before, let D be the Bézout number of F. This means that generically, F has D zeros. Okay? And when it does not have D zeros, it has infinitely many, and this is very bad, so the condition is infinity, so we don't care. In the average case, the idea is to consider mu 2 square to be the average, so it's a square mean of the mu f of the mu f zeta j to the square. Okay? And this, let's call it the mean square condition number, it's also useful. Now let me essentially finish. I am quite okay. Yeah.
So if you had a system that had isolated roots and a positive dimensional set, you kind of toss that aside, but I could be concerned about how well I can compute the isolated roots even though there isn't.
You're completely right. Let me put it that way. It's just what I just said before. When the definition I removed, the definition using perturbations, that's a standard definition and is the definition if you're going to do error analysis. When you're doing complexity analysis, essentially there is no a standard definition. I mean, Jim Renegar came for decision problems or discrete value problems in general with the idea of using the condition number theorem. And then what for multivalued problems, what I am saying is that occasionally you may use one or you may use the other. You may even, it will be your problem and your algorithm that will determine how you define condition numbers. But I will do an important, to close this first lecture and somehow to suggest the second. You may say, oh, but if you can define anything as a condition number, you know, everything is legal. I mean, the whole subject vanishes into some sort of irrelevance. The point is that this is not that completely true because of the following issue. First, the condition number will tell you something about the geometry of the problem. This is in general the way you are defining it. But more than that, if you look at the way condition numbers are defined, they have some sort of ugly feature on them, which is that they don't look easily computable. Look, for instance, at the first one we began, you know, norm of A times norm of A inverse. Okay? This is the condition number for matrix inversion. When you look at it, it looks like a bad joke. I want to solve a problem, namely inverting a matrix. Then whatever will depend on this whatever algorithm I'm using depends on this condition number. And if I want to know what is the condition number of my data, it turns out that I need to solve the problem to know it. That looks very, very bad. It's a bad sense of humor of whoever made this. How can one escape this bad sense of humor. This bad joke. Well, the idea was proposed, I would say at least was very clearly defined as a program by Steve Smale in a paper published in 1997 in Acta Numerica. What Steve proposes is the following. He says, I see complexity analysis of numerical problems as a two-part scheme. In the first part, and then he says between parentheses, upper bounds part. In the first part, he bounds the running time of a input X, for an input X, you know, my data, as a function of the size of X. You know, typically if you are n by n matrices, this means n. And if you are on polynomials in n variables with coefficients d1, dn, you mean some, you know, number of coefficients of this polynomial, with degrees, d1, dn, number of coefficients, which is a function of d1, dn, and n. So the size of your data, the number of real numbers you need to write down your data, maybe, epsilon, if you're looking for some sort of epsilon approximation, that depends, and definitely the condition of X. Okay? So that is exactly what we have been talking, for instance, in here. Now, in order to really understand, and that's what Smale will say, in order to really understand how fast conjugate gradient works, what you need to do is to eliminate the condition number. How you will eliminate? That's first part of his program. Second part of his program is to compute the probability that the condition of X will be greater or equal than T. Okay? And therefore, once you have the tail of this random variable, then you can compute the expectation of the condition of X, or here I mean the condition, but I should put G of the condition, okay? What do I mean by G? Well, here G is the square root. I mean, there is an expression, maybe a power, maybe a logarithm. It depends on what you have this function, okay? And now, in order to do this, one needs a probability distribution. Okay, so X is taken from some distribution, let me call it capital D. Okay? But once you have that, you eliminate your condition number from your estimates. And here I come to the answer to your question. You can use whichever condition number you want. If I want that my bounds will appear very, very nice, I will replace the condition number by e to the e to the e to the condition number, and then my bounds will be in the log of the, you see? But at the very, very end, they are all the same, because when I will have to come to this, if I did e to the e to the e, I will be in serious trouble, okay? So, or when I compute the log, I will find essentially the main character of my analysis, no matter how I disguised it. So, in the case that you may be interested in removing the infinite dimensional part, you may come up with a condition number that reflects the condition only of the finite part. You may come up with an algorithm whose analysis is in terms of that new condition number, and you will ultimately have to explain, if you want to, that your algorithm is efficient, by essentially saying, oh, the expectation of this condition number is just small, it's polynomial in this size. That's what you ultimately want. Let me tell you that essentially the second lecture that will be given by Peter will elaborate on this quite a lot. And with this, I think I can finish.